I call this meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. We do have a quorum today. Just a few reminders. We say at the beginning of every meeting, everyone here must be seated when they're in the hearing room. There's no standing or sitting in the walkways or aisles. If you need any further accommodations, please let staff know. Signs are not permitted in the hearing room or at the testifiers' table and should be left outside. Clapping and other disruptions are not allowed. Additionally, all of the testifiers who have signed up in advance have been provided with a time limit for testimony. Please adhere to these limits or you may be cut off, and it's not that we're trying to be rude. We just have a lot of bills and testimony to get to and want to leave time for member discussion and votes on our bills. In addition, people who choose to testify as members of the public will also be provided with a time limit. Before we move to our bills, we need approval of the March 7, 2024 meeting minutes. Representative Curran may have a motion.
Yes, Chair. Just wanted to note, we just needed to correct spelling on prevailed on a couple of lines there, but then I would move to approve it with that correction.
Wow. Thank you. So noted. I appreciate your eagle eyes looking at that, and so does our LA. all right. Any further discussion of the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of the March 7, 2024 minutes, signal by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, the motion prevails, and the minutes for March 7, 2024 are approved. The first bill on our agenda today is Representative Edelson's House File 4366. I will move that House File 4366 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. Representative Edelson, welcome back to the committee. I don't see that you have an amendment, so please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and it's good to see all of you in public safety. House File 4366 is the priority admission law. So this is dealing with the 48-hour law where a civilly committed person would be prioritized to go to a state facility. This law is, we created a task force last year because we are seeing a lot more people that are civilly committed, and there is a backlog in terms of our hospitals and in our jails. I just want to note for just the committee, I'm going to go through all the stakeholders, but we have been meeting twice a week. I've been convening the group twice a week to try to have these hard conversations. This is not an easy bill. There's no easy solution. Building capacity will take years. It cannot be done tomorrow. So with that said, this law was passed in 2018. We might hear that it has worked. Well, it did work for years. And it's not working now because we have, again, more people that are being civilly committed. So 18 members of the last session, we had passed 18 members of the Priority Admission Task Force that got together, and they have been working through priority admissions. Now, what was not addressed in this and what we are talking about in our meetings twice a week are the 48-hour rule that is leading to lawsuits and problems in our state. It could possibly decimate our mental health system. And as a clinician myself, I have to tell you, I have grave concerns. We have to have consensus on this. We will hopefully get there. But we had hospitals, sheriffs, direct care and treatment, NAMI, community mental health, omnibus, the omnibus person for mental health, counties, county attorneys, commitment defense, a member with lived experience, the chief of psychiatry. We had Commissioner of DHS, Jody Harpstead, and the attorney general, who also led the group. So, it is not one person, not one stakeholder can solve this. It will be the many. Before you really is the issue around medications in jails for public safety. And with that, the medications in jails would be administered and helped. That would be supported through DCT. So happy to answer questions about that after we hear from the testifiers.
Thank you. And it looks like we have Sheriff Brian Welk as the first testifier and then Sheriff Dewana Witt. So if you both just want to come on down to the testifier table, that would be great. And we'll start with Sheriff Welk. If you want to introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Committee. Thank you for having me. My name is Brian Welk. I'm the Sheriff of Cass County. Today I'm here representing the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, and I'm here to talk about the House Bill 4366. In the past year, our task force has united to tackle the pressing issue of a priority admissions head on. Together, we drafted and submitted a comprehensive report outlining our collective support and ongoing efforts in addressing this critical matter. The Minnesota Sheriff's Association primary the focus remains on preventing individuals from languishing in jails unnecessarily. We cannot criminalize mental health and cannot use jails as our institution. We've emphasized the importance of having qualified medical professionals administer medication within correctional facilities. To facilitate this, it is our intent to collaborate with DHS, DCT, to ensure that jails can contract the right professionals effectively. DCT has the unique expertise and knowledge to assist our jails to improve inmate care. It is essential to stress that jails are not equipped to serve as treatment centers. They simply lack the necessary resources and infrastructure. Living in Cass County, we're sixth largest in landmass, but yet we have no local hospitals. This highlights our unique challenges that we face. This underscores the urgent need for increased capacity within our mental health system. We're advocating for a clear timeline or mechanism that outlines when individuals in our jails must be transferred to an appropriate treatment center. I'm grateful for the opportunity to work alongside and continue to work with dedicated individuals on this vital issue. Thank you, Representative Edelson, for taking this tough bill on, and thank you for considering my testimony today.
Thanks for your testimony. Sheriff Witt, you're next.
I gotta talk much faster.
And please don't forget to introduce yourself, too, before you begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members, and thank you, Representative Edelson, and the Priority Admissions Task Force for your leadership on this critically important issue. I'm Hennepin County Sheriff Dwana Witt, and I oversee the largest jail in the state of Minnesota. My goal today is to share with you the complexity and the needs of the jail as it relates to this effort, the 48-hour rule, and the priority admissions changes contemplated in this bill. Today, my department is short 54 licensed deputies and 40 detention deputies. Our morning jail count today is 784, and 87% of those in our custody are being held on felony and violent offenses. The max bed count for the Hennepin County Jail is 839, and we are already over our functional capacity. This is important because this bill seeks to assist those with severe mental health needs, get quicker access to mental health services in a more secure and appropriate setting, as well as bring more services to the jail, and I do welcome that. We need more state capacity. Last year alone, my health care costs were $2 million over budget. That is not sustainable for the Hennepin County residents or the pressure it puts on our already overworked and understaffed jail. The 1115 Medicaid waiver contained in this bill with the addition of pretrial access will help tremendously, and we are thankful for that being included in the bill. This should not be an issue of jail versus hospital. We are lucky in Hennepin County to have a great partnership with the Hennepin County Healthcare. We are an example of how it can work. However, we should not be forced to hold people who the court has committed to other facilities. When we couple staffing shortages with increased needs of our in-custody population, it is a dangerous combination. We cannot do more with less. The Hennepin County Sheriff's Office currently has 10 total 48-hour commits. They range from 7 days to 167 days since their commit was issued. Many of these individuals require one-on-one care from our detention staff and increased welfare checks. As I hopefully made clear, this is neither compassionate nor is it sustainable. We need a comprehensive package to address these challenges, and I do appreciate this being taken on because it is important. But we have to remember, we have to lead with humanity, and people with mental health, our most severe mental health needs, do not get that in a jail setting. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, and just to both of you for being here today. I know you're both really busy, and appreciate your work on this issue. Do we have any other members of the public who wish to testify? Apparently we have two people signed up. The first is Sue Abderholden, and then next we have Dr. Ian Health, Heath. So Dr. Heath, if you want to come down to the table, that would be great. Welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. And I just want to say that the 48-hour law, it doesn't work because if there's no bed, you can't move someone. I mean, it really is as simple as that. It's also important to note that our mental health system has not been fully built. Adding to this is an increased number of people struggling with their mental health. Every day, we see the inability of children or adults to access the level of care that they need, where and when they need it. It ranges from not being able to schedule an appointment with a therapist or psychiatrist for months, to boarding in the ER, to sitting in a hospital bed waiting for a community bed or the state hospital, or simply ending up in jail. Thus, the solution is not just to add beds at direct care and treatment. We must address the shortages and lack of funding in the community as well, and we must increase the level of treatment we provide in the jails. People wait in jails to be deemed incompetent to stand trial and to be committed. All of this, frankly, can take months. During that time, and the time they also must wait to be transferred to DCT once committed, they should receive appropriate treatment, including injectable medications. We can help people not just watch their symptoms continue to worsen. The problem with the 48-hour law can't be solved by just adding beds at DCT. We need to invest in every step of the way of someone's journey with mental illness. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony. And I can't tell you how often I say the system isn't broken, it was never built to begin with, because I've heard you say that numerous times. Thank you. All right, next we have Dr. Heath. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Ian Heath. I'm a forensic psychiatrist, and I started my career working at State Operator Forensic Services. For the last 17 years, I've been at Hennepin County Medical Center, and I'm their senior medical director for the Department of Psychiatry. As the committee is aware, HCMC is a safety net hospital caring for those afflicted with mental illness, cognitive disorders, substance abuse disorders, many of whom have had contact with law enforcement. Sheriff DeWitt stated, we also provide the medical service for the Hennepin County Jail and understand full well the need for a solution to support all patients, especially those who are not receiving therapeutic care in jails or hospitals. We've partnered with Hennepin County Direct Care and Treatment and the Department of Corrections providing care for many patients. As an unintended consequence of the enactment of the priority admissions law, HCMC and other greater metro hospitals are no longer able to access direct care and treatment beds. Since 2014, the number of individuals who are committed in our care has increased by 20%. But discharges to state services has declined by 47%. Although HCMC provides care to complex patients, unfortunately there are patients who require a higher level of care that we cannot provide. We're currently caring for several patients who've been hospitalized for close to 2 years, one of whom is civilly committed as a person who is mentally ill and dangerous to the public. This particular individual has been hospitalized for 620 days. Within that time, he has assaulted on 120 occasions of at least 59 unique individuals have been assaulted during that time. He has constant 2-to-1 staffing. The patient is basically unable to progress in treatment. The physical plant of a community-based hospital is inadequate, requires us to use more stringent security measures. The hospital is not a place to live. This individual hasn't had a breath of fresh air in 620 days. To care for this patient, we've basically had to take beds offline because of the violence risk. We probably could have provided care to at least 100 patients if this individual weren't stuck in our facility. This then causes a backup in our emergency department, forces boarding, and causes us to turn away trauma cases. So this has some downstream effects for our facility and for the greater metro area and all. I respectfully ask for your support in alleviating some of the challenges jails and hospitals are experiencing by advancing an increase in capacity of direct care and treatment by granting a one-time exception.
Doctor, you're well over the 2 minutes. If you could wrap up, please.
Certainly. A one-time exception for 10 patients to move as soon as possible and increasing services throughout the mental health system. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. We're going to move next to member discussion. Are you on the list? Yeah, Representative
Tadke. Yeah, thank you very much, Chair Mueller. first thing, I just want to say thank you very much to Representative Edelson for all the work. This is a really, really difficult issue with a lot of moving parts and a lot of decades of neglect in places where we haven't been on things and able to have accomplished by the state. So I just really appreciate all the work in getting everybody together to move forward on things. And so there are some things that I really like in this bill that are really great, like the ability and the grants for working to make sure that there is more in jail care that is being done. So there are a lot of really, really great things in here. And I don't necessarily need responses to this. I just want to make sure to get on the record that there are a couple of things that as the group continues to work together on that I really hope they address in order to get some things done that need to be done for my community and my district. And the first one is as we talk about capacity, and I think that as multiple testifiers, the sheriff said that there's a really critical need for making sure that we have a timeline going forward on how long folks can be in jails, because jails are not the appropriate setting for someone to be in who is committed and experiencing mental health issues. And so that's not a place for people to be. And so I hope that we tighten that piece up. And then on the other side, I think that we need to make sure to have beds available, make sure that the beds that we do have are available as much as possible. And so the counties on the far end of this are placing folks as fast as they can back into the communities where we have that ability to do that. And then also evaluating folks in person or by Zoom or whatever that may be to do a more clear job of getting there. So there are a couple things that I hope that as the group continues to work together and find solutions on this that can work in the bill. Again, I just appreciate everybody's work on this and want to make sure that those are a couple three things that I'm looking at as this goes.
Do you have any comment on that, Representative Edelson?
No. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Chapke. Yes, that is most certainly, no one wants people to be, we want the appropriate bed for the level of treatment someone needs, and it's usually not a jail. It's not going to be the best. But again, as stated, increasing capacity in the current amendment that we have an increase via task force, the language that was in there, increasing capacity at DCT from 10 to 20%. We have immediately opening up beds, 10 beds, so that we can address instances like the doctor had talked about where someone has been in a hospital for over 2 years and 157 nurses have been assaulted in that process because it's not the appropriate bed. So hospitals aren't always the best place either. So again, this is not an easy bill. I'm not sleeping well, quite frankly. I hope that some of you are not either, because this is one of those hidden issues. It is not on me, it's on all of us. It's on all of the stakeholders. I know the sheriff spoke, and I know this distresses a lot of us. And so it's a pressing issue. I will just say that looking across the US, I have not seen a 48-hour rule like this. I have seen a 30-day, something like that. But we do need to build capacity. We need to do so in a realistic way that meets people's needs, though. So I guess I would just temper expectations. And just, again, I hope that the committee will encourage the stakeholders to continue to stay at the table, because this is a big issue.
Great. Representative Whitty.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Chair, Representative Edelson, I thank you for your hard work and compassion on this. I support your bill. And I've lived it being out on the streets and seeing mental health go up. And they were difficult times, especially as a crisis negotiator. It's easy to negotiate with someone who you can get them back into a regular. And Sheriff Witt and I had cases like this. So I appreciate you looking into this. And I understand the complexity and all that, and I agree that the 48 hour piece is probably something that needs to get revisited, because it was, we're kind of breaking that, and if we ever get back to that, that's great. I like that you started the conversations. There are solutions out there to look at some possibly regional facilities tied into our jails, so it can take the stress off of the inmates, but also on the jailers that are working in there. So thank you so much for this. I think it's going to make this is kind of alleviating some of that pressure, and you're totally right, there's a lot more work that we need to do on this. So I know Garofalo's coming back for the sports betting. If it doesn't, we definitely can use your help with this in the future. Thank you.
Any others? Representative Botney.
Chair Mueller, Representative Edelson, I just want to make sure that we're on the same page and we're understanding this right. Under page 2, starting on 2.21, looks like they're striking a 48 hours. The sheriffs have been very adamant about the importance of keeping the 48-hour rule Just want to make sure we're on the same page. I'd like to have you confirm that we're keeping the 48-hour rule. Is that protected at this time or not?
Representative Edelson.
Madam Chair, Representative Novotny, we are negotiating that right now with all the stakeholders. Everybody is at the table. The 48-hour rule is not working. If you look at the task force report, you can see that the numbers of people that have been civilly committed have gone up. Now, I want people out of jails, too. But where will they go? We are trying to increase community capacity. We cannot lock in IRFs. So we have tried grants last year that did not work. So, yes, we are going to try to negotiate and try to figure out a way to deal with the 48-hour rule, but I cannot commit that that's not coming away. We had a really good discussion yesterday, which is reflected in this bill before you, that, again, if something's not working, do we keep it? I guess I what do you think?
Well, we can't have... We can definitely have those discussions offline, too, between the two of you. But Representative Novotny, do you have follow-up?
I do have follow-up. And, well, my response would be we've got people that are making contributions and the task force makes recommendations. I think we should place heavy weight on what they say because they're the ones living with it every day. My next question is if we remove the copay for local jail inmates who receive the mental health meds, who's going to cover that? And is there any other costs that are going to come back to these counties? We've seen that Hennepin County Sheriff DeWitt testified that she's $2 million over. It makes me wonder what her original budget is that she's over by $2 million. What other costs are going to be coming down to the county?
Representative Edelson.
Madam Chair and Representative Novotny, I would have loved the task force to address the 48-hour rule, by the way, but that was not something that they did do. So that is what is left to me to talk with the stakeholders on. So we're trying to address that. As in terms of the copay, we are actually, that just came up yesterday. We are working with DHS to figure out how that would work. So I think it's a great question that you bring before the committee. I'll have to circle back once we know.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Edelson, do you know when it's scheduled or projected to go to judiciary?
Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe I am going to another four committees in the next 2 weeks, so sometime within that frame.
We have a deadline, so, and actually we are re-referring this bill anyway to judiciary, so that is the next stop.
Thank you, Chair.
Representative Novotny, anything further?
No, sir.
Yep, and just for the record, it's Sheriff Witt. People have said it.
I'm sorry.
A couple people, it wasn't just you, so just want to make that clear. Okay, let's see. Any other further member discussion? Representative Edelson, closing remarks.
Thank you, committee. I got nothing.
All right. I renew the motion that House File 4366 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Edelson and testifiers. The next bill is a Representative Pinto bill, House File 4538. And while you're making your way up to the table, Representative Pinto, I'm just going to remind people, you may have walked in late, but if you're here, please sit down. That was one of the, and if you're not able, there's plenty of open seats, so people might need to move in to accommodate that. Please take a seat. Representative Pinto, I believe your motion is that House File 4538 be placed on the general register. Is that correct?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
All right. Please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you so much, Chair, members. The bill itself provides for additional opportunity for venue for charging a case where a victim of sexual assault is mentally incapacitated, physically helpless, or asleep or not conscious. I'm going to have my testifier, she's the one who brought the bill to me, and have her describe a little bit further about it. I will just note before you turn to her that there's nobody with more expertise in cases of sexual assault than Karen Kugler, and she and I got to work together on several trials involving sex trafficking, and so got to see her at work, and she's the best, and so I'm so glad to have her bring this bill to me and then now to us. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, and welcome to the committee, Karen Kugler. And yes, your reputation is well known. I'm a prosecutor in another district, but I am also aware of the good work you do. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Karen Kugler. I'm a prosecutor with the Ramsey County Attorney's Office. I'm currently in a specialty assignment where I am responsible for charging pretty much all, unless I'm on vacation, cases of sexual assault where the assault was alleged to have been committed by an adult perpetrator. I also work with investigators, prosecutors, medical professionals, and victim advocates on enhancing cases of sexual assault so that we can have the best, most thoroughly investigated cases possible to take forward to prosecution. In the course of my work, I have come across cases which are extraordinarily frustrating because we have victims through no fault of their own who are incapacitated, found to have been drugged, and they don't know where the sexual assault occurred. And that is really, really difficult because one of the critical elements of the crime that we have to prove as prosecutors is venue or jurisdiction. And we can't charge a case in Ramsey County unless we know it occurred in Ramsey County. The exception being if the case involves a child. You can do it where the child is found. But there's no such exception for adults. And I had a case involving the same perpetrator and two different women who were sexually assaulted by him and found to have GHB in their system that they did not know they ingested. Both of them were rushed to the hospital. One of them woke to be intubated. And we believe we can possibly prove venue in that case, so we did go forward with charges, but there is an open question there. And the other case, we can't, because we know through geolocation on the victim's phone that it happened somewhere off 280, but we can't prove if it happened in Hennepin County or if it happened in Ramsey County. And because of that, we cannot charge the case. And it's incredibly frustrating as a prosecutor when you know the identity of the perpetrator, but you can't do anything about it. And so when I say know the identity of the perpetrator, that's through DNA. That's sexual assault exams where the DNA has been found. And the perpetrator was identified through the Minnesota database of known criminal offenders. As that DNA profile was run through the database, it was connected to this individual on both cases. So we know who did it. So I went to Representative Pinto and asked, is there something we can do about this? It just is not right. It is not justice. It's not right for the victims. And for that reason, I don't think I need to go into more details, but this is a really, really necessary bill. And I ask that you pass.
Thank you. And I don't think any other members of the public signed up to testify. So we will move on to member discussion. Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you, Representative Pinto, for bringing this bill forward. I think that this is a prime example of good governance. We're listening to prosecutors, listening to the counties, seeing what's going on and trying to make some fixes here because this is not justice, what's occurring currently. Chair Mueller, I know that you've also worked extensively in this field, and so I just wanted to say thank you both for bringing this bill forward and thank you to our testifier for reaching out and trying to find some fixes to a sorely needed issue.
Chair Beckerfin.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and just wanted to point out as you listen to this and you think about how unfair it seems that these victims would not see justice due to not being able to prove jurisdiction, this is an issue that's really common for Native folks when we're dealing with jurisdictional issues on tribal lands and where exactly the crime occurred and whether the feds choose to involve themselves and prosecute something. And so I just wanted to point out and kind of make that connection with the experience of a lot of folks in tribal communities that the jurisdictional piece and the complications there can be, even when we know who did it, and we know that a crime happened, if you can't prove that element, it makes it incredibly hard. So glad we're closing this loophole, hopefully, in this case, but just kind of wanted to draw that connection for folks as we're listening to this. Thank you.
Any further member discussion? All right, closing comments, Chair Pinto.
Thank you. Thanks again to County Attorney Kugler for bringing this to me and members. Yeah, this will be a really great fix. And I do want to definitely emphasize Chair Beckerfin's point. It is so complicated. There's jurisdictional issues in Indian country, and so hopefully this can be a bit of a help. Thank you, Chair.
And because of the support that there is for this bill, we've discussed amongst ourselves here that the motion is going to change now to be placed on the general register with a recommendation that it be placed on the consent calendar. And I believe that Lead Novotny is going to make the motion that House File 4538 be placed on the general register with a further recommendation that it be placed on the consent calendar. Is that correct?
That is my motion.
All right. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and the bill is further recommended for the consent calendar. Thank you. Thanks for being here today. The next bill on the calendar for today is House File 2828. It is a Representative Hussein bill. So I will move to lay over House File 2828. And I do believe, Representative Hussein, that you have an A1 amendment, and it looks like that it just changes the effective date from 2023 to 2024. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right, I will move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape you desire. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. And now your bill as amended is before us. Representative Hussein, please explain your bill.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Miller and member of committee. Today I have privilege to present House File 2828, a bill that will enable local governmental unity around the state to restrict or, if they see fit, prohibit possession of danger weapons, public land, and public buildings. When it comes to gun violence, local law serves the important purpose of addressing the unique issue and danger facing each community. My community in St. Paul and Ramsey County is no different. Our local leaders and law enforcement personally know what needs to be done to serve life, and this bill will give them the authority to make such a decision. The reality is very few states that generally allow local unities to have their own gun safety policies. Here in Minnesota, we take very serious the idea of giving control of an important policy to stakeholders and officials on ground. The leaders in Ramsey County community and St. Paul might make a decision that will keep children and families safe. The research is clear common sense. Gun law works, and American people are demanding that we do something to save our community and our family. Gun violence kills every year 40,000 Americans every year, and there's something need to be done, and we can do that today. This bill will save every life, but even the tragedy can prevent. It's one step ahead. So if we, one comment that I would like to share with my colleagues, in June 24, 2008, Morrison County Government Center, there was some person showed up with gun and had a hostage for county commissioners for 8 hours. And we cannot allow that in our state. We want to make sure that our local government feels safe and work in that environment. And that's all we're asking. And this came from my city and the county asking for authority this bill to prevent so they can have opportunity to restrength the gun law that they deserve.
Thank you, and I believe you have four testifiers, and I'm assuming this first testifier is Brooke Blakey.
Good morning, Chair.
Good morning. Please introduce yourself and begin. And actually, the mic looks like you might need to pull that closer. Perfect. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Good morning, Chair Molnar, Public Safety Committee. My name is Brooke Blakey, and I'm the Director for the Office of Neighborhood Safety for the City of St. Paul. Previously, I was a law enforcement officer with the Metro Transit Police Department, and I personally have been impacted by gun violence. I'm here today to support House File 2828, as well as share my support with House File 3672, which you will hear after this bill. As the Director of Office of Neighborhood Safety for the City of St. Paul, reduction and elimination of gun violence in my city is the main tenet of the work I do in my office. Simply put, gun violence is community violence, and it's well known that no city has been successful in arresting or prosecuting their way out of this problem. But what we have known is the City of St. Paul has engaged in the most comprehensive public safety strategy, which includes working with our rec centers, our libraries, and any other community space in which our children feel the need to be free and safe. I think really what is true about this bill is it offers the the opportunity for us as local government to control the ban of firearms in the government-owned and leased land, and will aid in the ground-up, community-based public safety approach that we have been enduring. Small things like committing never to bring firearms in a rec center or library with children, similar to committing to never bring weapons and ammunition into schools and daycares, show this will and the ability to build important relationships with community and the public safety personnel, in which I proudly served as well. Having this authority and commitments for local government paired with actions from every corner of the city, for every employee to every resident, visitor, and business owner will help the efforts of addressing and reducing gun-related violence in our communities. Now, perhaps more than ever, as we continue to address compounded crisis and enduring trauma far too many of our neighbors face, our Office of Neighborhood Safety stands to further usher our neighbors from crisis to wellness, and with it, transformational outcomes from every corner of our city. While there is much work to be done to realize the evolving body of work, our community members remain united to support this vision, which we'll continue cultivating together. I urge you to support House File 2828, along with the next bill you hear from Representative Pinto, House File 73672. I thank you for your time, and know that our goal is to keep every child and every resident in our community safe in the places that they feel safe in. Thank you.
Thank you, Director. Next up, we have Andy Rodriguez, and then the next testifier will be Mark McCabe. So if you want to work your way down towards the table, too, that would be great. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Moeller and Public Safety Committee members. My name is Andy Rodriguez. I am the director of the City of St. Paul's Parks and Recreation Department, which is nationally recognized as one of the top park systems in the country, with over 185 parks and 26 community recreation centers. Before becoming director, I managed the recreation center system within St. Paul, and I have a strong passion and understanding for what these facilities mean to youth and families across our communities. On behalf of the City of St. Paul and my department, I'm here to express our strong support of House File 2828, a bill to authorize local governmental units to decide whether to prohibit the possession of firearms and explosives in local government-owned or leased buildings and land. During nearly every hour that our facilities are open, there are children, teens, and families building skills, connecting with peers, recreating with families, and so much more. Safe, supportive spaces where our youth can connect around common interests with peers and positive role models alike are critical to the future of our city, and we will not tolerate any endangerment of those who trust us to keep them safe in these spaces. Because of the deeply accessible nature of our spaces, we don't turn anyone away from our services. The challenges that are present in our communities today also come into our public spaces, including our rec centers. As our state experiences increases in mental health challenges, substance abuse disorder, unhoused neighbors, and gun violence, these challenges are also present in those facilities. Unlike private, non-governmental establishments, which can regulate the carrying of firearms in their spaces, there's no authority for a local government unit to ban firearms from being carried into those local government-owned or leased buildings and land. Other governmental facilities, including most notably schools, have provisions in state law that permit them to ban dangerous weapons while knowingly on school property. Letting local governments have the local control and ability to ban firearms in government-owned and leased buildings like our recreation centers will be a critical step in helping to prevent gun violence within our communities. I urge you to support this bill along with the next bill you will hear from Representative Pinto, House File 3672, to ensure that we protect our children, families, and the staff that work tirelessly to keep our communities safe. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony, Director. Next up, we have Director Mark McCabe, and then on deck is Deputy Director Peng Yang, if you want to work your way down as well. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Mark McCabe, and I'm the Director of Parks and Recreation for Ramsey County. I'm here today to voice the county's support for Representative Hussein's bill, House File 2828. We appreciate that this bill and the following bill from Representative Pinto gives local governments the ability to control whether or not firearms can be brought into their parks and other facilities. There have been various issues within Ramsey County Parks and related facilities regarding firearms. One that I'd like to just reference and point out, in September of 2020, a father of a youth hockey player brought an assault rifle into the TCO Sports Garden arena facility in Vadnais Heights during a hockey game. And this obviously caused significant alarm, worry, and panic among youth, parents, and staff. Fortunately, there was not an act of violence, but it was very traumatic to an arena full of attendees. People still talk about that event. There's still follow-up from it. The spaces These spaces need to be safe and free of firearms so that everyone can enjoy these community facilities, that they can be safe, and again, places where our community can come together and do what they intended to do in coming into these facilities. So thank you again for introducing this bill. I'll turn things over to my colleague, Pang Yang, to share a few words as well.
Thank you, Director. Next, we have Deputy Director Pang Yang. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Hello, thank you. For the record, my name is Pang Yang, and I'm the Deputy Director of the Ramsey County Library. Like our recreation facilities and my colleagues here, libraries are havens and places of learning in our community. In 2022, 13.5 million people visited libraries across the state. A significant group of people who visit our libraries are youth and children. While guns are not currently permitted in our schools, when the school day ends and our kids disperse to join programs and services offered in our libraries, at that point, their protection ends. What happens in our communities happens in our libraries. This includes fun, learning, connection, and also, unfortunately, substance use, mental health crises, and exposure to violence. In my years of service to the public and libraries, in the St. Paul Public Library, and also in Ramsey County Library, I myself have seen people walk in with crossbows, with knives of varying sizes. And my colleagues across the state have had to engage with people with guns placed on public computer tables in views of others and in potentially dangerous situations. I recall vividly engaging with my colleague right after he had to call emergency personnel for someone who was shot in his back before he walked into a library. By giving local governments the ability to decide if they wish to ban weapons in their facilities, we give each community the opportunity to have a conversation about when and where guns are appropriate in the lives of our children and our community. Libraries are community social infrastructure. They are places to connect, to learn, experience joy, to find jobs and resources, to start their businesses, and also simply exist. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to speak in support of this bill today, and we are happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Deputy Director. We did have a few people sign up in advance, and so if I haven't called your name, I'd like you to not be sitting behind the testifiers table right now. If you can please move back to the audience. All right. I will decide what's going on here with the testifiers. We've got several people who signed up in advance. The first person is Linnea Palmisano. And then next on the list is Rob Doerr. All right, council member, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Lene Palmisano, and I'm here in my official capacity as the 13th Ward City Council member for Minneapolis. Thank you for allowing me to provide testimony on this bill this morning, Madam Chair. The City of Minneapolis supports House File 2828 and thanks Representative Hussein for bringing forward and carrying this bill. The City of Minneapolis legislative priorities support local authority as well as gun violence prevention measures. In my personal capacity, I see you here at your dais, and it reminds me of the several times per week that I sit on the council dais in Minneapolis. I am proud to serve my community, and I do so with no trepidation, but I also admit there have been times that I've been concerned for my safety, the safety of my colleagues, and most importantly, the safety of the community in attendance. I'm concerned about the safety because we don't have the legal right to prohibit guns at government facilities in Minneapolis. There has been a swift and large increase of contentious public meetings at many levels of government, county, school board, and city. I embrace and support everyone's right to attend public meetings, but that participation needs to be done safely with more limits on the ability to bring in firearms. I respect these regulations may vary greatly between communities or municipalities, but I strongly support allowing each entity to make those decisions for themselves and not be limited by state statute. I think about why weapons are not allowed and carefully controlled in courtrooms. It's because these situations can be clearly upsetting to people. It's about their family, loved ones, and those in charge can remove freedoms and determine an individual's rights. Very similarly, though, we enact laws, enforce laws, deny appeals by individuals and businesses alike. Whether it's a local issue or a foreign national policy, we have people showing up and packing City Hall because we are doing work very nearby. We're not in Washington or across the state. We're right down the street, just like every city has a City Hall. I fear that we've had real world.
We did have, we didn't start the clock on time, and so I don't know how much time you have left. My apologies, but you were given 2 minutes. I know you're over 2 minutes, so if you could please wrap up your testimony.
Sure. I welcome the public to City Hall, and I think they do so assuming we've made safe public spaces for them. In today's world, most of people would expect you can't be in these spaces in an uncontrolled way. So giving us the ability to regulate that could help us finally meet that expectation. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony. Rob Doerr, you are up next, and then Craig Burris is on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rob Doerr. I'm the Vice President of the Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus. We're opposed to this bill today. I want to be really clear who we're talking about here. This bill affects permit to carry holders. It's already illegal for people to carry firearms in public places unless they have a permit to carry. So everything that we've heard about concerns, the only people impacted by this bill are people who have a Minnesota permit to carry. That's it, because everyone else is already breaking the law. When there are shootings that have happened in St. Paul rec centers, it wasn't a permit to carry holder. It was a St. Paul city employee that who was already prohibited by city policy from carrying firearms. So when we're looking at this bill, there is only one small group of people that are targeted. And it was invoked about the ability to carry firearms in public places or in private businesses. The remedy for that is a warning and a request to exit. The penalty in here is an immediate crime, up to 30 days in jail and a $1,000 fine. It's a very stark penalty for somebody who is in every other aspect of life lawfully carrying. There's one other aspect of this I want to bring up. I've heard our friends on the law enforcement side testify many times about how firearms stolen from vehicles is a major source of crime. Now, what we're asking here is people who are engaging in the civic process, who have every right to carry in every other walk of life as they're in the public community, to now have to go put their firearms in their vehicles. I think this exasperates the very thing that we're trying to prevent, is actually guns getting into the hands of the wrong people, not guns in the hands of people who have been trained, certified, background checked every single year. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony. Next, we have Craig Burris, and on deck, we have Mercedes Cerez-Yabarro. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak today. My name is Craig Burris. I live in Lakeville. I've been a permit to carry instructor for over 15 years, and I developed and taught the first college-level women's self-defense course in Minnesota that allowed women to learn about personal safety while getting college credit. I'm here today to oppose House File 2828. By allowing each locality to determine their own rules about what government buildings and land are legal to carry in, you would be creating a patchwork of rules that has no effect other than to stifle our right to self-defense and entrap law-abiding permit to carry licensees into breaking the law. There is no basis for the change in these laws. Since the inception of the Minnesota Citizens Personal Protection Act, licensed permit to carry holders have proven to be the most law-abiding of all Minnesotans. Additionally, you would be inadvertently giving criminals more access to guns. Every time someone with a permit to carry needs to enter a prohibited area, they need to secure their firearm, usually in a vehicle. The security lock boxes that fit in vehicles are suspect at best. Most can be opened with a screwdriver in under 5 seconds. In the past 30 days, I've been in multiple city and county parks, DMVs, libraries, and the Lakeville City Hall. Imagine if I had to look up the law for each city and county to know if I could legally enter a park, city building, or county property. It seems like this change to our law can only have one goal, to stop law-abiding Minnesotans with a permit to carry from actually carrying their firearm for fear of breaking the law. This will do nothing to stop crime, as we already know criminals don't obey gun laws. I, like the nearly 400,000 other Minnesotans who have a permit to carry, are not the people that you need to worry about. Hopefully you all read the report from Minnesota's Sentencing Guidelines Commission, who recently reported to the legislature. This report stated that 40% of convicted gun crimes in Minnesota didn't even get the minimum mandatory sentence. With numbers like that, it's hard to believe that we're even having to discuss limiting the rights of law-abiding citizens. I urge you to oppose HF 2828, stop trying to put onerous regulations on law-abiding citizens, and instead focus your efforts on the criminals who are committing the crimes. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony. And the last testifier that we had signed up is Mercedes Perez-Yabarro. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Hi, my name is Mercedes Yarbro, and I'm writing to share my testimony regarding HF 2828. Thank you, Representative Hassan. Last year, my family experienced a devastating tragedy due to gun violence involving a St. Paul City Parks and Rec worker. My younger brother, who was only 16, fell victim to this senseless act of violence when he was shot in the head by the parks worker, who was also a license to carry. He was over the age of 26 years old at the time. This incident serves as a stark reminder of the dangers posed by individuals in possessions of power who misuse firearms. It highlights the grave consequences of poor judgment and the misuse of authority, particularly when firearms are involved. The parks workers' actions exemplify how some individuals, even those entrusted with public service roles, may abuse their authority and use firearms not for protection, but to assert dominance and control over others. Not approving HF 2828, in my opinion, would only exacerbate the risk associated with gun violence. Granting individuals the authority to carry firearms without proper oversight and accountability measures could empower them to wield their weapons as tools of intimidation and coercion rather than a genuine protection. I implore you to consider the potential ramifications of this bill and the implications it may have for public safety, the well-being of our communities. Rather than fostering a sense of security, it should protect our community and create an environment where power dynamics and fear won't be an issue. In conclusion, I urge you to approve HF 2828 and let us work together to promote policies that prioritize the safety and security of all individuals without compromising the fundamental principles of accountability and responsibility. Thank you, attention, for this matter. And just on a side note, I'd like you guys to pay attention to who's on the stands and who's it affecting. The ones who are opposed to it look a certain way, and that's no question why. It's the communities and people of color who are being affected by gun violence the most. Our kids are the ones affected. Protect the kids.
Thanks for your testimony. We're going to move on now to member discussion and Representative Hollins. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Hussein, for bringing this bill forward. And thank you for the testifiers. I think it's a very interesting conversation. I do support this bill for a number of reasons, but one in particular I want to bring up is in my district, at an elementary school in my district, there was actually a gentleman who had a license to carry, brought a gun in, and was playing basketball with a group of students in after school, and the gun went off and shot him in the foot. And he was charged because it was a school and because you're not allowed to bring guns into schools. But the reality is a lot of people go and play basketball at rec centers. I have several rec centers in my district, and the thought that my kids could be in these rec centers playing basketball, minding their own business, while somebody's gun goes off in their pocket, you know, and I know he meant no ill will, right? I know that he was just a parent of a student that was there. But the reality is these are dangerous weapons. And if we can't send our kids into public facilities and assume that they're going to be safe, that's really a problem. The other thing I noted, and I guess I don't really have a question as much as I want to note that on line 1.11, it says a local government unit may prohibit or restrict. So really, this is a local control bill. This is about saying if your municipality wants to do something like this, they are allowed to. And if they don't want to do something like this, they don't have to. And I understand that because I grew up in a small rural area where there's not a lot of people. And now I live in a major municipality. And it's like a vast difference how many people you run into when I live in the city of St. Paul versus where I grew up. you know, I knew basically everybody that I was around. I interacted with them. Yes, there were lots of lawful gun owners in the areas where I grew up because it was very rural. And, but it just wasn't the same interactions that we have now in a major municipal city. And so for that reason, I really appreciate this, because this is giving control back to local governments and saying, if this is something that you don't want to see happen, then put something in place to stop it. And if it's something that you don't care about and it works well for your community, then you don't have to do it. So thank you for bringing this forward. I'm very excited by this.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. And I have a question before I have a comment, and it's kind of a question to whoever can answer it. Can a business, a church or whatever, a public space, what's the process of going and getting a sign that says this is a gun-free zone? Like, is there hoops to go through? I mean, if can you just put up a sign that says it's a gun-free zone? Is there anyone that can answer that for me?
We'll call on Mr. Johnson to answer that.
Madam Chair, members, yes, there is. It's in statute. It's section 624 and it's subdivision 17. 624.714, excuse me, subdivision 17. I'm not going to review the whole thing, but it does not require any specific hoops. You don't have to get approval, but there are very specific requirements related to the sign, what it needs to look like, the size, and those sorts of things.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you, Ben Johnson, for that. It seems as if we actually already have the tools necessary for what you're trying to do in this bill, Representative Hussein. I really wanted to focus, I mean, we've been on committee now for a long time, Chair Mueller, and you know we've listened to many of these bills, and I rarely speak to them because I don't have the same background as a lot of other people do. But I've been in classes, and I've been in school, and I've been a teacher for a long time. And I've talked a long time about how this is this type of a culture of violence, and this culture of that legislating out of this is never going to happen. One of the testifiers said that someone brought a gun to a hockey game, and though nothing happened, it was traumatic for everyone, and we need to prevent that from ever happening again. This isn't about an act of someone breaking a law. This is about the perception of someone who wants to carry a gun. This is the perception of that, the perception of what could happen, the perception of someone who has already followed the law, but oh my goodness, here's a scary thing that's happened and that I'm traumatized by this. And while that trauma may be real, the truth is that this law or this bill that you're trying to do, Representative Hussein, isn't going to affect what you're hoping to affect. It's about the perception of guns. It's already illegal to carry a gun when you don't have a permit to carry. It's already illegal. And it's already illegal to bring a gun to a gun-free zone like a school. It's already illegal when you, I had a friend who was a permit to carry, and she was a strong gun advocate, and we were at a hotel, and she goes, oh gosh, this is a gun-free zone. I have to leave this because I'm not, and the penalties for that are severe. This bill, Representative Hussein, is not about local control. This is about making people who are following the law, and people are scared of that, and making that perception now criminal. And I just think that this is something we need to really have good conversations about, because, man, we already have the tools available to prevent a lot of gun violence with many of the laws that we have that we should actually enforce, with many of the signs that you can put on this, on buildings, and with having education. All of those things are already available to us. So why we would have a bill that would criminalize people who are already trying to follow the law just to squash the perception that guns are scary. I feel very strongly that while I rarely talk about gun bills because I don't have that background, this one feels like it's a step too far. So thank you so much.
Yep, and just to correct the record here, the local government don't have the ability to put signs up or the tools. That's what this bill would allow. And that maybe Mr. Johnson could speak to the signage requirements and what those can apply to.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I didn't complete the answer, I guess. The places that were mentioned were all private entities. The ability to ban guns in 624.714 does only apply to private businesses. It does not apply to government buildings. The prohibitions on carrying in schools and carrying in courthouses is in 609.66, which is the statute being amended in this bill.
Next, we have Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Representative, for bringing this forward. I just first wanted to note that one of the examples provided in testimony today happened in my community. And, you know, while I understand the argument of perception, I just have to counter that with, as a gun owner and as somebody who enjoys shooting as a sport and going to a safe range and using them in a safe manner, and someone who has had a carry permit and carried my gun when I felt it was necessary, perception, it's an interesting thing to talk about because guns are used to kill living things. So I'm really curious what other perception there is to have when an adult brings a rifle to a hockey game. I just, why wouldn't you be fearful of that? Why would you not be fearful? Why are you bringing a rifle to a hockey? What is happening here? Like, what should the perception be? I do have to disagree. There was a comment that this bill is directed at carry permit holders. I disagree. I outright disagree with that. I believe that this bill is directed at combating gun violence as the leading cause of death among children. I find it really difficult to swallow that every time this conversation comes up, we're just really concerned about being able to keep our guns and bring them wherever we want to and just completely ignoring the reality of what's happening to children in our country. I find that appalling, and I say that as somebody, again, who enjoys using guns in a safe way, and we still have the right to do that, and I still believe in our Second Amendment rights to do that. But we have a problem, and we have kids dying. And I'll just lastly say that I also find it interesting that we're talking about educating people and keeping children educated about guns. And then when we talk about other things, it seems like we're trying to keep them in the dark about just about everything else. But, man, they should really learn about guns. And I just have a really tough time with that argument as well. So thank you for this. Our communities do need to have the ability to protect public spaces. And this is something that I would like to see in my community, too. So thank you.
All right. And we have multiple members on the list still. We still have two more bills. So we'll keep moving here. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try to keep that in mind and be as concise as I can be. I do have a question for nonpartisan staff, Mr. Johnson. Under the current law, a private establishment can ban guns. What is the effect of that ban on an individual? So if I have a permit to carry, I walk into a store that has a sign that says guns are banned in this facility. Mm-hmm. What is the process that store owner, establishment owner could go through to redress my violation?
Mr. Johnson, if you can answer that.
Madam Chair, Representative Hudson. So there are, in 624714, there are a few different provisions, and I just want to make sure I'm getting the language up. But the owner can directly ask the person to leave. That is always one option. The other option is to post the sign that I mentioned, which is in subdivision 17 of that particular statute. Refusing to leave or bringing a gun in without, you know, paying attention to that sign is an offense, and I am trying to find the specific penalty so that I don't say it incorrectly.
My memory, that might be a petty, but I'm not quite sure.
I believe that's knows. Correct okay. as well. But okay.
Not sure if anybody sure. knows that.
I'm going to keep looking. Okay. I can supplement it.
All right. Go ahead. Representative Hudson.
Thank you. That's adequate to make the point that I'd like to make, which is if you had a bill that said that city buildings, public buildings, could follow that process where they can put up signs and you're dealing with a petty, maybe you get a citation, I might be able to go along with it. But what we're seeing here is a scenario where we're ignoring the fact, I mean, Representative Curran brings up the fact that guns are designed to kill living things. Indeed, sometimes those living things are trying to kill you, which is why people like to have guns, because they want to be able to protect themselves and the people around them, the public at large, their family, what have you. And so that recognizing that essential difference, and this seems to be a recurring problem in our discussions where we fail to acknowledge the distinction between people who act in bad faith with malice and people who are acting in good faith, trying to be law-abiding individuals, those two categories of people, are you're not going to have the same type of interaction with them. And so the establishment owner who has to approach somebody who either knowingly or unknowingly violated their ban on firearms, when they ask them to leave, that's when you're going to find out in that moment whether they're a good actor or a bad actor. And past that point, the response is going to be the same. If they're a bad actor, things are going to go sideways. This bill does not change that. If they're a bad actor, things are still going to go sideways. The only thing this bill changes is that if they're acting in good faith and they're otherwise law-abiding, they're guilty of a misdemeanor and they're going to go to jail. That's why I can't get behind this.
Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. And thank you, Representative Hussein, for bringing it forward. I do think that you have good intentions. I think that you want to see less gun violence. Now, I think we've heard 6 or 7 gun bills in this committee, ranging back to last year. But using Representative Curran's own words, ignoring the reality of what's happening in our community. Well, according to the Sentencing Guidelines Commission data in 2023, there's a record number of cases involving gun violence, 1805, offense committed with a firearm. Only 30% of those cases ended in a conviction with a mandatory minimum sentence. 48% of those cases were either not charged, dismissed, or the mandatory minimum sentence was waived. That's the real issue that we're not addressing in this committee. That's the real reality of what's happening in our communities that we're not getting at. So while we sit here and we want to pretend that we're going to actually make our spaces safer with laws like this, it's not getting at the actual heart of the issue. In fact, I actually saw somebody on the other side of the table here that had a bill that's going to waive the mandatory minimums for gun violence. So I don't want to hear about this one-sided monopoly on compassion regarding gun violence that one side of the aisle continues to drumbeat over the other when it's not getting at the heart of the issue. This is another one of those bills. Thank you.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Ng, and I was not going to talk about mandatory minimums, but now you've cited my bill. Yeah. It is my bill.
Yep.
And it doesn't waive mandatory minimums. It gives discretions back to prosecutors. And in these cases that you keep mentioning, I haven't heard anybody mention the details of why those cases may have been dismissed or why there may have been a departure. 48%. Nobody mentioned the details of any of those cases. Details matter. In order to charge a case, you need evidence. In order to convict someone, you need evidence. Departures happen because of extenuating circumstances, mitigating circumstances. You have to talk about those details. But this bill, thank you for bringing it, Representative Hussein. This bill was about giving local governments the opportunity to protect the people that come into their public spaces. I'm a former city council member. This tool would have been great to have when I was a city council member. This tool would be great to have for other local government entities to be able to make a decision of how they want to protect the folks that come into their public spaces. So thank you for bringing this bill. I'm looking forward to moving it forward.
Representative Novotny.
There's another one coming.
Go ahead. Representative Novotny.
Chair Mueller, I can rehash what everybody's already pointed out, but it won't do any good. But we keep hearing the same type of testimony about incidents, and in every testimony that we've had in this, and I suspect in the bills coming forward and the ones we had last week, there's not a single case that anyone cited where what happened was allowed. We talk about the author has the bill mentioned the 2008 shooting in the Morrison County courthouse. Well, that was already prohibited. Definitely the act of holding people hostage was prohibited, but just him bringing a firearm into the courthouse was prohibited. The St. Paul Park employee was already prohibited from carrying a gun, and I'm pretty sure the act that he was ultimately convicted of was prohibited. I think Representative Engen nailed it on the head when another law that we're not going to enforce on anyone other than the people that are law enforcement following or law following, it's just table magic. Table magic is important. Pay attention to this hand while this hand is the problem. We can keep going around and around and around. As Representative Engen said, there's a problem. And the concealed carry people aren't it. Making someone that is a concealed carry user less safe doesn't make you safe. Doesn't make you safer. And in fact, I would submit that restricting concealed carry from facilities makes you less safer, because in many cases, a good guy with the firearm is the solving of the problem. A good guy with the gun is so often what takes care of the bad guy with the gun. We'll keep repeating that as this goes forward. If we keep hearing these bills that are anti-public safety, I feel. Like I said, you can distract and talk about the part that you don't want to talk about that's ugly. We won't talk about that. We'll talk about window dressing. It doesn't matter. Members, I urge a no vote and I request a roll call.
I am a strong supporter of this bill, and before you close, I'm just going to make a few comments. I hear often a good guy with a gun is what stops a bad guy with a gun, and I'm thinking of the image of President Reagan being shot surrounded by security officials. We have a problem with guns in this country, and we're hearing so many gun bills in this committee because of the problem that we have with guns. Guns are the leading cause of death of children and adolescents in this country, and that's why we're hearing these bills. These are important discussions to have, and I'm glad we're having them, but just want to be clear as to why, as chair, I have decided to hear so many gun bills. Representative Hussein, closing comments.
Thank you, Chair Miller, and I appreciate for you to give me the opportunity to testify and bring this bill forward. This is affecting my community. This is affecting my backyard, in my district, every day. And my city and the county wanted this bill because the statute that we have is not giving opportunity for them local control. And I have many dialogues, both sides, and all we talk about always is, hey, we want to give power to local government to decide what they wanted to do with. And I would say, in library, when I'm taking my kids, I don't want people to have a gun. They should be having a pen and book and reading, not a gun. There's no in earth people have a gun in libraries. And that's one thing that we're talking about, it, that we want to give opportunity our local government to control it. Rec centers, we shouldn't be having a gun. We should be exercising, playing basketball, and do activities with families, members, and swimming. We shouldn't be having a gun. Gun kill people, not people kill guns. And what we is doing today and asking is just to give our local government to do the authority, because in St. Paul and Ramsey County and in our district is different than rest of your district in greater Minnesota. You don't see this violence that we see every day. And that's why we're bringing this bill forward, because our statute is not protecting our community. Thank you.
Thanks. And Lee Nabat, you requested a roll call, but we're laying this bill over. So I will renew the motion and lay over House File 2828 as amended. Next, on a similar topic, we're going to have Chair Pinto, House File 3672. I also will move to lay over House File 3672. Chair Pinto, please explain your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yes, indeed, there's a quite a linkage between these two bills, because the bill that you just heard was a specific example of municipalities taking, being able to take a particular step to protect their communities with respect to firearms. And House File 3672 takes a broader approach to say that the various preemptions that are in statute right now that are preventing communities from making decisions that may go beyond the extensive laws we have regarding guns in our state, those laws would be removed as a result of House File 3672, noting that the state laws still stay in place, Constitution still stays in place. What is removed is are these provisions. And, Madam Chair, we heard testifiers regarding the last bill, and I have no testifiers that I'm bringing. I know that there are public testifiers, but we'll look forward to hearing from them and having a discussion with members of the committee. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And we are running short on time, and we do have another bill after this, so I'm going to have all three testifiers just make their way down now. Again, it's Council Member Palmisano, Rob Doerr, and Craig Burris. Please, please, please keep your comments to 2 minutes, and we'll start with Council Member Palmisano. Welcome back, and you still have to introduce yourself again for the record, even though you were just here.
Sure, thank you. Hello, I'm Lene Palmisano, City of Minneapolis Council Member, here to testify in support of House File 3672 on behalf of the City of Minneapolis. I want to first thank Representative Pinto for carrying this bill. I think it is critical that local governments have the ability and authority to regulate firearms in a way that suits their community. This bill promotes an approach to gun regulation that is not one size fits all. Local elected officials can instead craft gun safety ordinances that are both responsive to the unique needs of their community and representative of residents' needs and desires. As Minnesota's largest municipality, Minneapolis's needs vary significantly from that of even neighboring suburbs, but especially rural areas. This bill allows for that nuance and specificity. I know many members of this committee, both Republican and Democrat, have expressed concerns about crime or gun violence in Minneapolis, especially since 2020. I have too. One aspect of addressing this is supporting our responsive public safety services, like sworn officers, 911 dispatchers, and mental health co-responders. Another important aspect are preventive measures like diversion programs, youth mentorship programs, and this, the ability of a municipality to create local ordinances related to gun safety. Please allow cities the opportunity to do what is best for our communities and the safety of our residents. Thank you for allowing me to testify before you today on both bills and to Representative Pinto for this bill. Thanks.
Thank you. Rob Doerr, welcome back again. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Rob Doerr, Vice President of the Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus. The real danger of this bill is this creates a very complex patchwork of local laws for something that would be a statewide permit. Your permit to carry is a statewide permit, lets you carry anywhere in the state. I know some of you travel through many, many municipalities on your way down here, and it's just untenable to think that your firearm may be legal in one county and land you with a misdemeanor 90-day in jail charge in another county, maybe because your magazine has 10 rounds and the limit in that county is 7, or the limit in that city is 7. The patchwork is just going to be a minefield of laws that lawful people intending to remain peaceable are going to get tripped up under. The other big concern is it removes the provisions under the permit to carry law, which prevent cities or counties from altering the application for a permit to carry. They could add in any additional restrictions that they want, which would be an equal protection issue for those people seeking to exercise their rights. Thank you.
Thank you. And then Craig Burris. Welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you already know, my name is Craig Burris. I'm from Lakeville. I'm here today opposing HF 3672. Removing state-level preemption would create a patchwork of onerous gun laws for law-abiding Minnesota gun owners. On the trip to the Capitol today, I drove through Lakeville, Burnsville, Eagan, Mendota Heights, and St. Paul. If HF 3672 passes, it's likely that I would have had to look up the gun laws in each city and plan my route or what I am carrying to comply with a patchwork of gun laws. It means that one city might require people who want to carry to have $1 million liability insurance policy, and another could raise the permit fee to $1,000. Laws like this are designed to do one thing, discourage people from carrying and owning firearms. They have nothing to do with public safety because they only apply to law-abiding citizens. I, like the 2.5 million other law-abiding gun owners in Minnesota, are not the problem. I urge you to oppose HF 3672, focus on criminals, and not trampling the rights of law-abiding Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony. Thanks to those testifiers for keeping your testimony succinct as well. Appreciate that. We'll move on to member discussion. Representative Russell.
That was quick. Missed my opportunity the last time, Madam Chair. Thank you.
You got it now.
You know, a lot of the stuff I'm just looking at going, is there an agenda here? You know, and I've heard it time and again, there's no agenda here. But everything in these bills lacks one thing and does one thing. It lacks stopping violent crime. And people can say guns kill people. Okay. You know, you can say it all you want. People kill people, folks. I can take my Glock out and set it on the table, and it's not going to do it by itself. It's not going to hurt anybody. It's just going to sit there. If an evil person picks that son of a gun up and wants to do somebody harm, that's where the crime comes. That's where the horrible thing comes in. It's not the gun itself. It's the act that they commit. As being someone who was shot in the line of duty, as being someone who suffered from gun violence myself, individual decided he wanted to kill me one morning. Tried to shoot me in the face, ended up shooting me through the arm while I was trying to disarm him. Trying to keep from having to kill him. All right? So you'd think I'd be somebody who's going, hey, rah, rah, let's stop gun violence. You know, but that's violent crime. The person committed an act of violence against me. The person committed an act of violence against that dear lady who was up here testifying about her brother that was killed. I've been asking, I've been here for going on 8 years now, folks. And I've been asking from the beginning, let's deal with violent crime. Let's deal with violent crime. Because the leading cause of death for children is violent crime. Leading cause of death for, you know, most a lot of these folks, violent crime. I don't know. I'm just spitballing here because it was thrown out there, leading cause of death for kids was gun violence. But if we're gonna tackle these kind of things, let's tackle it from the right direction. Violent crime, let's stop it. Let's stop it. Let's actually do some work and stop it. Not put more restrictions on law-abiding citizens. Now, I still have a permit to carry. I still carry in public. Why? Because those were the tools of my trade. Those were the things that I was trained to protect people with, to help people. And in a public place, whether it's a city hall, wherever, restaurant, wherever, should a bad actor try to hurt someone? I want to be one of the first ones to put my life on the line to stop them. As a civilian now. As a civilian. I am no danger to anyone. I've spent the better part of my adult life protecting my neighbors. And I continue to try to do that. When you say there's no agenda, and yet you hit us with barrage after barrage after barrage of taking the rights and trying to criminalize law-abiding citizens, looks like a duck, smells like a duck, folks, it's a goddamn duck. And you're trying to put the onus and the burden on law-abiding citizens and gun owners. You know, I have no question for you, Representative Pinto. I wish I did, because, you know, it would be the same answer as is given all the time. And there's no sense in trying to question a distinct agenda to attack the Second Amendment of our law-abiding citizens. That's all this is. It doesn't stop suicide. It doesn't stop violent crime. I've been in many courthouses where I've put my weapon in the box to go do my job, to do my civic duty. But there is always guards at that door. Now, you're asking people to disarm themselves, make themselves vulnerable when they could be a protector to somebody in public places, who's going to help them? Who's going to help you? Don't carry guns if you don't want to. But don't throw the burden on the rest of us to expose ourselves to being victims. I'm not going to do it. So I'll get out of the way. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yep, and just to correct the record, the leading cause of death of children is gun violence. It is, that includes suicides and accidental deaths as well. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very quickly, thank you, Representative Pinto. Local control has been raised quite a bit during our conversation today on both of these bills, and I just want to point out, first of all, I won't go through a list, but boy, I wish we really embraced the concept of local control with everything else that comes through this house. That would be absolutely fantastic. Seems to be pretty selective application. But in this case, I think the point needs to be made, and by the way, it should be selective application because local control is not a value unto itself. The very fact that we have a constitution is recognition that some things need to be to some degree centralized. The fact that we have legislation that we're passing that applies to the entire residency of Minnesota is indication that there are times where we need to impose standards. I think that what should drive those decisions is whether or not we're serving the individual rights of the people in our jurisdiction. The inflection points in our country where we have had crises, constitutional crises, have occurred because people locally were trying to violate the rights of the folks in their jurisdiction, trying to deny their humanity, trying to encroach upon their God-given freedoms and their constitutional rights. And we have recognized time and time again that it is appropriate for a central authority at any given level to take action to ensure that that does not happen. And so these preemptions are appropriate. They should stand. And I oppose this bill. Thank you.
Chair Becker-Finn.
Thanks, Chair Mueller. And I was going to point out the same thing you pointed out as far as the leading cause of death of children includes suicides and accidental shootings where kids access firearms they shouldn't have access to. And then I just wanted to comment on, you know, a lot of it is, you know, I think if you're talking about people's motives, that's not something that we can do in this space. That those are the rules of this space of working here. I mean, as also someone who's been here 8 years, I know those are the rules, and there's a reason, because then it gets real personal if you start talking about why people are doing things instead of speaking to the language that's in front of you and the impacts that it'll have. So there's a reason we have that rule. And then I just wanted to point out, you know, the presence of a gun does change things. In a domestic violence situation, the presence of a gun changes things. At a hockey game, the presence of a gun does change things because the power is right there. And somebody has that power and other people don't. And for years, you know, and I started out serving in the minority when we were arguing different kinds of bills. And I often thought, you know, to make that point, I thought about getting a permit to carry and taking out a gun to make the point that it would change everything. But I didn't do it because I was afraid somebody who's carrying who has a permit to carry would overreact to that and that I would not be safe. And so I think, you know, we can't lose sight of, it's not vilifying people who own guns. It's the fact that the presence of a weapon that can do that much damage that quickly does change things. It changes the power dynamic. And so I think that's why it's important. And I know that's how I feel about it. I can talk about why I do things or what I think, but I just think that's an important piece of it that we have not touched on yet, is that there is a higher risk to folks when a firearm is present, and that's real. We have data, we know that. And we know that ourselves from being in the presence of one. So I think it's a good discussion. I think we absolutely need to be having these discussions out in the open. And I thank you for bringing these bills forward and not being afraid to have the hard conversations, Chair Mueller.
Representative Witte.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. I'll make a quick Representative Pinto on this bill and the other one. Have we had conversations with our stakeholders, with law enforcement, to see what their thoughts are on this bill and working together to make sure our communities are safe and are we bringing enough forward for that. Thank you.
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Representative Witte, for the question. I can't speak for the other bill. I can say that this one, I've been in touch with all sorts of folks. I don't know. I mean, one thing about this bill, I guess, as long as this conversation has gone this way, is we've kind of gotten into the substance of particular proposals. This is really a process bill, right? This is saying, hey, the constitutional, there's the constitutional protections, there's protections under state law relating to preemption. So municipal ordinances regarding guns, many of them are preempted even if this bill passes under, it's called Mangold v. Richfield, and I'll direct folks' attention to that case that talks a lot about the ways in which municipal ordinances are preempted. Just there's not this extra step. So in any case, so I don't know that I can answer about specific law enforcement groups, but I will say that my bill, because it's more of a process bill, it's kind of less about what individual communities choose to do. Thanks.
Representative Woody? No? All right. Lee Novotny.
Chair Mohler. Once again, I wish we could vote on it today, but we won't. We'll save the hard stuff for the floor. I'll just reiterate my point. If you have any questions about my position on good guys and bad guys, people, I've got a dozen videos off the top of my head I can show you that a good guy with a gun did make a difference. And I'm just going to, if we use the same definition of what a child is, because no, never mind that the children are already prohibited by multiple state laws from carrying firearms and doesn't seem to make a difference. If we use that same stat, the same numbers that they used last week where they said if you're a child and they use the definition of a child as being under the age of 19, which would be a year after they turn 18, when most of us consider them to stop being a child and become an adult. We use that definition and apply it to the other end from birth. The number one cause of death in the state of Minnesota is abortion.
Closing comments, Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Chair. And members, Representative Hudson, he's correct that local control gets argued different ways at different times by different people in this body. One thing I'll point out, though, is we are an exception around the world in the number of folks that we lose to firearms, the majority of whom, by the way, are lost to suicides. So to Representative Grossel's point, let's remind ourselves there's violence with firearms, there's suicides, there's accidents. The number of people who get shot by toddlers in this country, just by accident, right? Is extremely high. So the idea that we cannot take steps to address that and not have communities recognize, I often hear from my colleagues that, well, in our rural community, things look very different. Yeah, I understand that they do. In my city of St. Paul, things look different as well. And the idea that we have to accept that we have rates that our members, that our community members are dying is so much higher than the rest of the world. They have mental health issues as well. They have all sorts of issues in the rest of the world. They are not losing people the way that we lose in our country and our society. So, members, there's still preemption. Again, I want to direct you to a case. I'm happy to talk with folks in more detail later about this. Well, there's all sorts of ways in which municipal regulation will continue to be preempted, but the idea we're going to add an additional level of preemption on top of everything else that's out there, preventing cities to do what they need to do to protect their residents, that is crazy and it is wrong, and it's leaving our residents much worse off. So members, when the time comes, I'd urge your support for the bill. Thank you.
I renew my motion and lay over House File 3672, and we have a few minutes we can go over. I don't think this one will be nearly as controversial as the last one. Welcome to the committee, Representative Olson. I will move that House File 3871 be placed on the general register. I also see that you have an A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape you desire. I will go ahead and move the A1 amendment. Any discussion to the A1 amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Olson, your bill as amended is before us. Please, if you can keep it short, and your testifier as well.
Perfect. Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill, House File 3871, basically just expands the ability to prosecute individuals who are on unauthorized military, like they're unauthorized to be on military facilities. Currently, the law says that if you're at Camp Ripley and you're not supposed to be there, you're in trouble. You're committing a crime. We have a lot of National Guard armories around the state that does not apply. When I was a commander of a truck company a couple years ago, I had $18 million worth of government assets that I was responsible for on the other side of a fence. There was no, it was a federal institution, so there was actually criminal charges that could be placed, but this would just expand it to National Guard armories and military facilities as well.
All right, and Executive Director Kerr, please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Don Kerr. I'm the Executive Director of the Department of Military Affairs. This is an agency bill. Thank you to Representative Olson for carrying it for us. And as he stated, this really just expands the authority. As we have seen our presence increase, particularly at Arden Hills, we kind of noticed that this might be a very helpful tool in maintaining the security of our facilities around the state. Felt it was appropriate to expand the context from only applying at Camp Ripley to also applying not only at our armories but also our air bases and our Army Aviation Support facilities. And with that, Madam Chair, any questions?
All right. And we didn't have any members of the public sign up to testify in advance. Do we have any member discussion to the bill? All right. I am not seeing. Sorry, Chair Becker-Finn.
I just wondering real quick. Thank you, Chair Mueller. I assume there would be signage so folks would be aware that, you know, I'm familiar with the Arden Hills facility, and there are some parts of it that it's not clear. I've never known exactly whether I'm on county land, or I assume I'm on county land, but I guess I don't have the GPS coordinates. Just want to make sure that folks would be aware that they're trespassing and wouldn't be an accident.
That's a great question, and that is actually in my district, too. So I really need to know the answer to that question. Director Kerr.
And Madam Chair, Representative Becker-Finn, yes, actually, it is all fenced, and it is marked restricted area, as is Camp Ripley, and particularly the portion that is the impact area, which is where it rises to the felony level. That will only apply at Camp Ripley, and that really relates to the impact area where we shoot dud-producing munitions, where there's great danger to the public to be wandering around out there, though still people seem to want to do it.
Thank you. All right. Any further discussion? I'm looking more to the side now. So all right. Closing comments, Representative Olson.
No, thank you so much, Madam Chair, for hearing this bill.
All right. I renew the motion that House File 3871 as amended be placed on the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. And with that, that is today's agenda, and we will see you later. This meeting is adjourned.